Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Capital One has a fresh take on banking. Now you can open a new savings account in about 5 minutes and earn five times the national average. Banking with Capital One means five times the savings toward your dream honeymoon, or five times the savings toward your family's ultimate vacation, even five times the savings toward just feeling good about saving. It's time to make your savings goals come true. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A. member, FDIC.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Emilio San Pedro, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 7th of March, these are our main stories. The global number of coronavirus cases has now reached 100,000. The head of the World Health Organization called the virus's spread deeply concerning. The Islamic State group has said its militants carried out an attack in the Afghan capital Kabul that killed more than 30 people. And the French publisher Hachette has decided not to release the memoirs of the Oscar-winning filmmaker Woody Allen after a protest by employees. Also in this podcast, the Vietnamese song about hand washing in the era of coronavirus that's gone viral around the world. The number of people that have been infected with the coronavirus since it first emerged in China has now surpassed the 100,000 mark. That, at least, is the estimate by the Johns Hopkins University in the U.S. The vast majority of those infected are in China, but other countries are struggling too and have seen rapid increases in the number of patients. The World Health Organization has created a list of 20 essential medical products, including ventilators and oxygen. Governments should make sure they have sufficient supplies, says the head of the organization, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus. He also said the best way to tackle the virus was to contain it, to slow down its progress.
Every day we can slow the epidemic is another day hospitals can prepare themselves for cases. Every day we slow down the epidemic is another day closer to having vaccines and therapeutics, which can in turn prevent infections and save lives.
I asked our health correspondent James Gallagher just how significant that 100,000 number is.
Well, I'll be honest, it's just a bit of a number, really, isn't it? Us journalists like it because we get to write a headline that says 100,000, but not much has really changed from when there were 96,000, and not much will be that different from in a couple of days' time when it's like at 107,000. But what it does tell you, I think, is the global picture is now getting quite interesting because, you know, for a long time, we were only talking about cases realistically in China. But you look at the China data, they're barely going up day by day. Look outside Wuhan and you're not really getting any cases at all. You've got an almost complete plateauing in China. It's where the rest of the world's cases are now that I think the real story is.
And which countries then are of most concern?
Okay, so the ones I'm keeping an eye out on, South Korea, Iran, Italy. And although they don't have a huge number of cases yet, I'm really interested in the United States because we know they've had problems with their testing. They're in double figures of deaths already. Now, you see double figures of deaths and you're thinking, oh, they must have thousands of cases. That's not what they're reporting. They're reporting 200-300 cases. So I think there's a much bigger problem in the United States than they're reporting so far.
And there was a problem with the testing and all sorts of issues about whether enough kits were out there. But they have, President Trump has signed this bill into law for spending $8.3 billion to help improve that.
Yeah, that's a humongous amount of money. The challenge, though, is if it becomes, you know, almost too little too late, because what you need to do is get in there early, because the bigger an outbreak you already have, the more efforts you need to put into in order to contain it. That's why so many countries are focusing on finding those first few cases, containing them so that you don't get a big outbreak. And if the United States does have more cases than it's currently reporting, then it's going to have to go to greater lengths in order to stop it.
And is there any sign that countries are working together to slow it down?
Yes, the World Health Organization is coordinating things at a global level in order to do that. I mean, today it's produced its like action plan on how countries should work together in order to produce the best scientific data and evidence on how to combat the virus. And yes, you see international sharing of information, like where are cases coming from? And so that gets fed back to the countries where they think imported cases have come from. So you do see this global collaboration. And actually, it's quite reassuring to see that happen, because that's the way that we might be able to contain this.
Well, as James Gallagher just mentioned, there are signs that the coronavirus is being controlled in China, with the numbers of new infections and deaths there beginning to stabilize. But after more than 6 weeks of quarantine and shutdown, the pressure on Chinese society and economy is starting to tell. As other countries consider how best to handle a major outbreak of COVID-19, John Sudworth has been looking at the impact of China's efforts to deal with the disease across health, education and business.
In an empty university gym, a karate instructor is leaping and kicking. But something's missing. Students. They are all online instead, visible on Dr. Feng Hongpeng's laptop. Each of them leaping and kicking away inside one of the 30 boxes that divide the screen. I'm just teaching the basics, Dr. Feng tells me. When they come back, we'll strengthen the training. In the fight against the virus, every school and college in China has been closed now for more than 2 weeks. For medical student Shen Xiangyi, the new way of learning at Tsinghua University has even brought some unexpected benefits.
And I find it quite convenient studying at home because I don't have to ride my bicycle all the way through all the buildings. And I can just get the other class, like clicking on my computer. And I think I got more time learning, really.
In another building, we find the university's Internet Control Center. It handles almost 4,000 online courses a week. So standing in this room, you get this extraordinary sense of being at the center of all of these streams of learning, this amazing confluence of teaching and interaction between students and their professors. As you wander around, you can pick any screen. This one here. This one looks like a psychology lecture. On the screen itself, you can see the notes that the students are being presented with, a diagram of a brain. That's a physics lesson going on there. And in big full screen, a very jovial looking professor, I have to say, in a waistcoat sitting in his library. That looks like a law lecture. All of these streams of teaching coming in, the nerve centre of learning, as it's all now been franchised out into the virtual world. But the virus has exposed China's weaknesses too, with cover-up and delay in the early days helping it to spiral out of control, overwhelming the health system. The wider impact on China's economy, with its deserted subway trains, empty highways and shuttered businesses, has been dramatic. Look what's happened to car sales, for example, down 20% in China in January and more than 80% in February. Air statistics are just as stark, with the number of flight departures from China's busiest airports dropping to a fifth of their usual number. Meanwhile, the karate class is coming to an end. With the infection rate falling, some Chinese schools are due to begin the slow return from next week. But China offers a warning about the need for timely action against the virus, and it has some way to go yet in this fight.
John Sudworth. In Afghanistan, the Islamic State group has said it carried out an attack in the capital, Kabul, on Friday morning that killed more than 30 people. Dozens more were wounded when gunmen opened fire on crowds attending a memorial ceremony. Our correspondent Sekunder Kermani has sent this report from Islamabad in neighboring Pakistan.
If Gunshots, then screams from the crowd interrupt the live broadcast of a speech from the rally. Those on the podium run for cover. A number of senior political figures were amongst those attending the ceremony today, including the chief executive of Afghanistan, Abdullah Abdullah, though he was not hurt. This same event, commemorating the death 25 years ago of a leader of the Shia community, was also attacked by the so-called Islamic State last year. IS have not been part of the recent negotiations between the Taliban and the United States. They're far less powerful than the Taliban and were recently pushed out from most of the territory they control, but are clearly still capable of deadly violence. Last weekend, the Taliban signed an agreement with the US. Since then, they've continued to launch smaller attacks on Afghan security forces elsewhere in the country. The insurgents are due to begin talks with government representatives next week about a comprehensive ceasefire and about the political future of the country. Today, President Trump acknowledged the risk of the militants seizing power, saying it's not supposed to happen that way, but it possibly will.
Sekunder Kermani. Now, Woody Allen has won 4 Oscars and has been nominated 24 times, but now his memoirs will not be released. The French publisher Hachette said the decision to cancel the book was a difficult one. It follows a protest by staff and long-running allegations that he molested his adoptive daughter, Dylan, charges that he's always denied. From Washington, our correspondent Gary O'Donoghue told me more about why the book isn't being released.
Well, quite simply because they faced a sort of barrage of criticism from their own employees about having taken on the book, which only really emerged in the last week or so that they had and were planning to publish this memoir. And also they faced a huge amount of public criticism from a very high-profile character named Ronan Farrow, who is Woody Allen's son. And he's also the brother of Dylan Farrow, who accused Woody Allen, if you remember, in the 90s of abusing her as a 7-year-old. And Ronan Farrow had also written a book, also published by Hachette, believe it or not, called Catch and Kill, which had sort of chronicled the whole business of the Me Too movement and attempts by men to try and prevent women from telling stories of sexual violence and the whole Harvey Weinstein affair. So you can see the sort of the complicated set of relationships, but Hachette found himself in the middle of all this, in a sense trying to ride two horses by the look of it.
And it's hard to overstate, isn't it, just how big of a case this was when it first all emerged in the 1990s.
No, it was huge. I mean, it's worth saying he's always denied the allegations and nothing he's not been convicted of anything at all. But I think there have been times since then where he's struggled to get actors to work with him. And it's said certainly that this book was touted around a few other publishers last year before Hachette seemed to agree to take it on.
Gary O'Donoghue. A judge in London has handed down a 2-year suspended jail sentence to a seafood salesman for smuggling endangered eels worth $70 million out of Britain. Border Force officers found a live consignment of baby European glass eels, originally from Spain, hidden under a load of chilled fish at London's Heathrow Airport. Lisa Hampley reports.
Gilbert Koo, who's 67, was caught when Border Force officers at Heathrow Airport discovered 200 kilograms of European glass eels, which were on the verge of extinction. It was the first seizure of its kind in the UK. He'd smuggled 16 consignments over 2 years after importing them from within the European Union. He kept them in a barn in Gloucestershire before repackaging them to be exported to Asia. It's estimated the illegal trade in tiny transparent baby eels from Europe to Asia is worth about £3 billion a year. On arrival, they're farmed and sold on as a delicacy. Koo was found guilty on 6 charges, covering the banned export of goods and failing to notify authorities about the movement of live animals. The judge said he played a leading role in a large commercial operation which had a significant environmental impact on the European glass eel.
Lisa Hampley. You're listening to the Global News Podcast. Still to come, we hear from scientists who say that lettuce grown in space is just as nutritious as when it's grown on Earth. Plus,
what's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's new, pussycat? Whoa.
The a new musical featuring the hits of Sir Tom Jones with an 18th century twist. But first, we go to Syria. It may have been a quiet day in the skies above Idlib thanks to an agreement reached on Thursday by the Russian and Turkish presidents, but the lull in air attacks was not mirrored on the ground, where hundreds of thousands of civilians have been displaced by the fighting. Turkey backs rebel fighters in Idlib, but has less sway over hardline jihadists there. Our Middle East editor, Jeremy Bowen, has been monitoring events from Istanbul.
Ceasefires come and go in Syria. The one just agreed by Russia and Turkey is a reprise of the last one they had in Idlib. It fell apart after the Assad regime, supported by Russia, Iran and various militias, launched this winter's offensive to try to recapture the last Syrian province held by rebels. The new agreement is likely to be a respite, not a permanent solution. It could open up some opportunities. The plan to create a humanitarian corridor, if it works, will be good news for the hard-pressed civilians in Idlib. Turkey and Russia both had good reasons to agree a ceasefire. The most urgent was pulling back from a direct military confrontation between Turkey, a member of NATO, and Russia, a power with revived global ambitions to match its nuclear arsenal. But there are also economic ties, as well as the political relationship between Presidents Erdogan of Turkey and Putin of Russia, which is useful to both sides. But the fundamental contradictions remain. Turkey and Russia support opposing sides in the war. Russia's ally, President Bashar al-Assad of Syria, is not a party to the ceasefire. A chapter of the Idlib tragedy has ended, but the story isn't over. Far from it.
Jeremy Bowen. It's one of the biggest and most controversial infrastructure projects in Africa. The Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam on the River Nile has been costed at around $5 billion and would be the largest hydroelectric power plant on the continent. Now Ethiopia has launched a crowdfunding campaign to raise money for it. I asked our Africa regional editor, Mary Harper, why Addis Ababa had chosen this unusual way to finance the project.
One reason why the Ethiopian government have called on members of the public to donate money for this dam is because they seem to be a little bit over budget. The dam costs billions of dollars and it seems that they need more than they expected. So that's one reason, is to call on people to help meet that shortfall. But also it seems it's a kind of way of trying to promote national unity and also a way of showing America that it really is quite angry with America's, what Ethiopia sees as, meddling in this whole project, because the Americans have been trying to mediate a dispute that Ethiopia is having with its neighbours, and Ethiopia is fed up with the Americans, and it's almost like saying, we're just going to go ahead, do it on our own, our population is going to fund the dam and we're just going to get on with it no matter what our neighbours think, no matter what America thinks.
And the Trump administration has been weighing in on this as well.
They have, absolutely, because there was meant to be a deal signed between Ethiopia, where this gigantic dam is being built on the River Nile, and the countries that are most worried about it, because they're terrified that the dam is going to consume so much water from the River Nile that it's going to deprive them of precious water. And so the US has been mediating, there's been lots of meetings in Washington, and then at the last minute, just before a deal was meant to be signed, Ethiopia pulled out, said it wasn't happy with the deal, and it was just going to go ahead unilaterally.
And it's been opposed by other countries nearer to Ethiopia, hasn't it?
Yes, yes. I mean, the main countries that have been making a fuss are Egypt and Sudan. There's been times when Egypt has been really actively saber-rattling and inviting very hostile reaction from Ethiopia. These are two giants on the continent, and the fact that they both depend on the same river for all this water makes things very complicated. Ethiopia has a massive population of more than 100 million. It's very poor. It's desperate for more electricity. So it's insisting that it builds this huge hydroelectric dam. And Egypt is just extremely alarmed by this because it thinks that its population will not have enough water for its agriculture, for its industry and for people to drink if this dam just consumes so much of the River Nile before it can trickle on to Egypt and Sudan.
Mary Harper. The American space agency, NASA, says lettuce grown in space is just as nutritious as when it's grown on Earth. The findings suggest that in the future, astronauts could produce their own food on longer voyages. Richard Hamilton reports.
Scientists at NASA's Kennedy Space Center in Florida analyzed three batches of lettuce grown on the International Space Station between 2014 and 2016. They compared the space vegetable to some grown on Earth under similar conditions by controlling the humidity, carbon dioxide and temperature. They found the levels of nutrients in both types of lettuce were very similar, and that the vegetable from the space station actually contained more microorganisms. Joya Massa, who's a plant scientist with NASA, was the lead researcher.
The lettuce crop grown on the International Space Station, when returned frozen, was analyzed both for chemistry and microbiology. We looked at the nutrients that were in the tissue, and we looked at both the culturable microbiology, or the organisms that could grow on petri dishes, and the sequence of the community of the plant microbiome. And the results indicated that the crops were very similar to their earth-grown counterparts and that they were safe to eat for the crew.
The scientists chose red romaine lettuce for this experiment because its seeds germinate reliably, and they also thought the astronauts would actually want to eat it. Over the years, space travelers have had to endure the likes of freeze-dried ice cream, liquid salt and pepper, and dehydrated prawn cocktail. But Joya Massa said the astronauts tried these lettuce leaves with cheeseburgers and tacos and concluded they were delicious. The researchers have now sent other seeds to the ISS, such as kale and cabbage. So could this be the tip of the iceberg? Scientists are cautious, warning of challenges ahead before these extraterrestrial plants become a sustainable food source for astronauts. The obstacles include a lack of sunlight, as well as different gravity and radiation levels in space.
Richard Hamilton. Now to a story of two Toms. Well, two Tom Joneses, actually. A new musical featuring the hits of Sir Tom Jones will open here in the UK this autumn. Not about the Welsh singer, but rather his 18th century literary namesake. The producers of What's New Pussycat are basing their show on Henry Fielding's comic novel, but with a 1960s twist. This report from our entertainment correspondent, Colin Patterson.
It's Tom Jones.
It's not unusual to be loved by anyone.
Meets Tom Jones.
The world of romance.
It's a good night to be abroad and looking for game.
Henry Fielding's comic novel, The History of Tom Jones, a Foundling, was published in 1749. It told the tale of a West Country philanderer entering London society and being seduced by an older woman.
Goodbye, madam. I regret I must take my leave.
It was turned into a United Artists film starring Albert Finney, winning Best Picture at the 1963 Oscars. And it was the cinema version which inspired an unknown Welsh singer, Tommy Woodward, to change his name to Tom Jones. Within a year, he'd had his first number one. Now everything's come full circle.
What's new, Pussycat?
In September, a stage production will open at the Leeds Playhouse, using the songs of Tom Jones to tell the story of the literary creation, Tom Jones, with the action transported to 1960s swinging London. It will be called What's New Pussycat? Wes Bennett-Pierce is the senior producer.
I think it's really close to Henry Fielding's novel. All the characters are there, all the ones that everyone maybe remembers and loves. They're just told in a really new way. In our version, Tom Jones is an up-and-coming pop star who's thrust into the bright lights of the big city, and the character of Mary is an up-and-coming fashion designer. But Sir Tom's music has such a storytelling aspect to it anyway that the music just fits perfectly with the novel.
And it doesn't take much imagination to work out how certain Tom Jones songs might fit into the story of Tom Jones, the literary Lothario.
Sex bomb, sex bomb, you're my sex bomb.
Colin Patterson. Now back to the coronavirus. As the number of people that have been infected continues to rise, the authorities in many countries are trying to enforce the message that we have to wash our hands to protect against the spread of the disease. Well, in Vietnam, health officials have taken a unique and lighthearted approach and released their own song about coronavirus prevention, and it's since gone global. The hand-washing song, as it's titled, is accompanied by a dance challenge featuring hand-washing motions and peace signs. The dance, which has taken the online world by storm, was choreographed by a popular dancer in Vietnam, Quang Dang.
My dance, I'm so happy that my dance can spread the right information, the right knowledge to a lot of people to use this, because when they practice, when they learn the dance, they learn the move. There's a lot of bad things happen in the world because of this virus. And I think in this era, in this time, in the dark time like this, only music and dance can connect people.
Quang Dang on the hand washing song. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Emilio San Pedro. Until next time, goodbye.
Capital One has a fresh take on banking. Now you can open a new savings account in about 5 minutes and earn 5 times the national average. Banking with Capital One means 5 times the savings toward your dream honeymoon, or 5 times the savings toward your family's ultimate vacation, even 5 times the savings toward just feeling good about saving. It's time to make your savings goals come true. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A. member FDIC.